And we're syncing up in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, sync.
Nice.
I want to start today's episode.
Oh, wow.
By saying,
oh, okay,
if it's your birthday today, happy birthday.
Is it your birthday today, Ian? Is that why you're saying this?
It's not my birthday today. I just thought it'd be nice if someone were listening to this and it was nice. Their birthday. They'd be like, wow, those two guys are talking directly to me.
That's true. And we could even, like, people could send this out, like, send it to people on their birthday.
Oh, that's really smart. If it's someone's birthday today, send them this episode.
I like it.
From the bottom of our hearts, Ian and Will. I also have some other pretty big news for you.
Oh.
I watched the first episode of Rings of Power.
What? Nice.
I know. A long time ago, and we haven't recorded since then.
It's been a month, I think, since we
It's been a hot minute.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So you watched a long time ago, but you did not watch the second episode in that long time.
That's correct. I've been busy since then.
That's fair. Did you like it? Were you into it?
Yeah, it was pretty good. Yeah. I didn't really know what was going on, but it was good.
Fair. Similar to Andor is the one that picks up, I think, around episode 2 or 3. I forget.
Start making shows that work right away.
See,
I don't want all the setup.
This is an interesting thing. I don't think this is intentional. I want to put that out there first. I don't think this was intentional. However, the whole slow beginning that builds into an excellent thing is very Tolkien. Like, the Silmarillion, the first, like, 100 pages are, like, elf migration patterns. And Lord of the Rings, the first half of the first book is before they even make the Fellowship. So, like, it's kind of a Tolkien thing to have a slow beginning that's, you know, establishing a lot of things that will matter later. And the Rings of Power
explain Andor.
Definitely does that. That's true. That's true. I don't know why they did the whole 3-episode pilot effectively for Andor. I mean, it works. Like, once you get through those 3, you're like, oh, I gotta know what's gonna happen next. But yeah, if you only watch the first 1 or 2 episodes of Andor, I don't think you're gonna get
hooked. Which I did over the course of 2 nights. I watched half of it one night and then I watched half of it the next night. I was like, boy, I love Star Wars, but this is taking a long time.
I will say, once it gets going, it does. But I understand that not everybody wants to nobody wants to spend 3 hours hoping that something might be into them. They might be into it. So.
No, most of October for me was watching The Haunting of Hill House.
Really?
Yeah, it's really good.
Is that like a horror TV show? Something?
Yep.
Okay. Was it a haunted house on a hill?
Kind of. It wasn't on a hill.
No.
It was owned by people named Hill.
Oh.
Originally.
Underhill?
But the whole time, all I could think of was, high on a hill sits a big old house with something wrong inside.
Nice.
That's from The Secret Garden.
Which Ian was in once upon a time.
I was a topiary.
He was a topiary. That's not true. I think I first heard reference to that show outside of our conversations like last year. I had never heard of that show before we met. You mentioned it quite a lot, and then I'd never heard mentioned it until like a year ago.
It's a really good show.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they say.
It has Lily's Eyes, the quintessential
male
musical duet.
Really? What about the one from Into the Woods? What's the one with the two princes? I forget the name.
I don't know. Was it called Lily's Eyes?
It's not called Lily's Eyes.
And does it go, she has my lily's hazel eyes?
No, that's not it, I don't think.
You know who's going to hit us with the information on our Twitter account?
I think I can guess.
The one and only at Davey Nelly.
That's true. I bet Davey Nelly, I bet he knows Hazel Eyes or Lily's Eyes, whatever it is.
Lily's Eyes? Yeah, we almost sang it like 3 times
together.
Oh,
that's right.
College.
I remember that.
Yeah.
You never did, though.
Never did.
So, well, that can
be for squares.
Be rectified. There's still time.
Okay. That was good. It's solid. Welcome, everybody, to our podcast. We don't just talk about musical theater and TV
transition.
Shows. Yep, that's the number one best intro I've ever had. This is Reference Frames Podcast, the one and only podcast where physics meets movies and other mixed forms of media to teach you how life works so that you can leverage gates better.
So true. Episode 1, throwback. Wow. That's all the way back.
Well, I was watching a behind-the-scenes stunt thing about
on our
Pirates
podcast.
Of the Caribbean.
Oh, okay.
Our podcast.
Did we make
a behind
the scenes stunts on our first episode.
I was behind the scenes. I don't need to know what was going on.
That's true. That's true.
It was difficult. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We always start our episode by acknowledging anything we've gotten wrong, but we can only acknowledge what we've gotten wrong if people point it out to us. And so far, nobody has. So
we must have been perfect. Flawless.
Yeah. Once more, we're flawless. And that's just who we are.
Dodge that bullet. Whew.
After that, we get into the meat and potatoes of the show, where Will reads to us a script that he's written in his most dramatic Dungeon Master voice. So without further ado, do you want to do the script?
I'd love to.
Okay, take it away, mister.
Dorothy Gale has had a rough day. It's bad enough she's had to live in sepia-toned Kansas her whole life, but when her beloved dog Toto bit their wealthy neighbor Elmira Gulch, the cantankerous crone procured an order from the sheriff for the dog to be euthanized. I know, I did not remember that either. Toto managed to escape from Miss Gulch's clutches and fled to Dorothy, who saw no other option but to flee her home to save her friend's life. Upon seeing the folly of running away from home in the middle of the Great Plains, however, she returned to her uncle's homestead, only for a tornado to strike. Unable to make it into the storm cellar in time, she is forced to seek safety in the farmhouse instead, and is swiftly knocked unconscious by a shattered window. Upon regaining consciousness, she finds the entire house uprooted and being flung about within the cyclone. Looking out the window offers some baffling sights, including a pair of men rowing a boat through the buffeting air, an old woman knitting in a rocking chair, and a cow lackadaisically mooing, seemingly untroubled by its present situation. The farmhouse then plummets to the ground, the furniture flung about wildly as she clings tightly to Toto. All at once, the house is still. It has landed, and somehow Dorothy and her faithful companion have managed to survive the ordeal. Upon opening the front door, however, she finds the world has changed. Where once there were only various shades of brown, she finds herself faced with a veritable panoply of technicolor marvels. Colossal, vibrant flowers, a pool of deep blue water bedecked with giant lilies, and verdant hills all around. She finds herself in Munchkin Land, in the Land of Oz, and is soon to begin an unforgettable adventure. So yeah, that whole dog nearly being euthanized at the beginning, did not remember that.
So what?
Yeah.
It starts so sad.
I will say, the opening of that movie is kind of crazy. Like, the effects for the tornado are insane. I don't know how they did that in, like, 1950, I forget what year, 54, maybe? But, like, it's
impressive, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, I get why it was such a big deal when it came out. And still is. I think it's still considered the most viewed movie of all time.
What?
It's a wild, wild beginning to that movie. But, yeah. All right. So, Ian. Wizard of Oz.
Color.
What was that?
It's got to be color.
You think so?
I think it's going to be color. You spent a lot of time on colors.
I did. That's true. You sure it's not like tornadoes or vortices or something like that?
I mean, I thought it definitely could be, but you used the term what was that word? Panoply.
Panoply.
Panoply. Panoply, technicolor.
That's true.
You brought out sepia, verdant.
That's true.
You can, I don't know. I think you played your hand.
Fair enough. You are correct. We are doing color. Brief etymological aside. You mentioned I said panoply.
You dangled that.
Oh, it's such a good word. So I like the word panoply. It's good. Actually, I know it most intimately from the Song of A. Arundel, which is a Lord Tolkien poem in the Fellowship of the Ring. But the word panoply is super interesting. So are you familiar with hoplites at all, Ian?
Vaguely, I know that a hoplite is a warrior of Greek.
Yeah.
Roman.
Greek. You're right.
Greek origin.
Yeah. Yep. Hoplites were like kind of the heavy infantry of most Greek city-states back in the Hellenistic and classical period. They're called that because they wielded a hoplon, which is the large round shield that we're all familiar with from 300. That's a hoplon. And hoplon just comes from the word for arms or armor. It's like the Greek root word, hopla, I think is. And panoply, nowadays it kind of means like a fancy smorgasbord, like a large collection of very fancy things. But it used to mean a full collection or suit of armor. And therefore the word originated as pan, meaning all, and hopla, meaning arms and armor. So it was all the arms and all the armor combines to make a panoply, a big suit of full armor. Super interesting. Total aside, it has nothing to do with physics, but I learned that while I was writing the script. I was like, oh, that's a fun little divergence.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. All right. So you're right, Ian. We are doing color.
All right. Color it is.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So first I want to put this out. It is important to keep in mind that color isn't just a physics thing. Color is really a combination of physics, biology, and neurochemistry. There's a lot of things that go into perception of color, what color means, what color is. And we'll talk about some of the other stuff. The physics is actually not that complicated. It gets more interesting when we bring in some of the, you know, biology, neurochemistry stuff. So,
yeah.
So the physics of it, not that terribly complicated. So we discussed this before. We talked about our scene from The Two Towers where the sunlight was being split by the window of the sunset, the big waterfall. Haneth Anun, I think. Anyway, where Frodo like saw like the rainbow being split out of the light.
Right.
We talked about the light there as being an oscillating electric and magnetic field, right? It's this thing that is permeating through space. It's this electric field that's shifting back and forth between two different directions and a magnetic field alongside of it. And we talked about how it could be created by an antenna where you have like a charge and you move it up and down really quickly. And that generates this field that will propagate outwards. And this oscillation, this charge that we're measuring on a antenna moving up and down, that oscillation can be done at a single frequency. Let's say we're moving it up and down at a constant rate, right? Maybe every second we go up and down, right?
Sure.
So we're wiggling that charge up and down. It's creating that field, and that field oscillates at the same frequency as the thing that's making it, right? And so in this case, if we're moving it at a single frequency, that light, that electromagnetic wave that's being created by this wiggling charge, the color of that light is what's known as a spectral color. Because it's only one frequency, it is only one color, and that color is going to be on the rainbow. So Roy G. Biv, spectral colors just means all the colors of the rainbow. So red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Right? Are you familiar with Roy G. Biv, I hope?
I'm familiar with the Roy G. Biv.
Who could forget Roy? What a great guy.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's if you have a single frequency, right? You're moving this charge up and down, it creates one color, a monochromatic light somewhere on the rainbow.
So you're telling me that color
mm-hmm.
is controlled by how fast your particle moves up and down.
Exactly. If you wiggle it faster at a higher frequency, it'll change the color. It'll change where in the rainbow the light's coming from. And so this is where it's useful to bring in the biological aspect of color. So color is a perceptive thing. We see color, right? In physics, it's just whatever frequency it is. But the reason we're able to perceive different colors is because we have three different types of cells in the back of our eyes, in our retina, right? These are called cone cells. You might be familiar with this. They're called
rods and cones. Rods and cones.
You get it. They're called cones just because of the way they're shaped. It's not a very complicated naming convention. But each one of these cones is sensitive within a given range of frequencies. So, for example, one of our cones, the frequency, the one that detects the lowest frequencies of this oscillating electric field, you can imagine again this antenna making it. The lowest frequency.
For those of you at home, he's wiggling his finger up and down to look like an electron moving up and down.
Exactly. And these lowest frequency cones, they're sensitive to around very high frequencies, around 460 to 600 terahertz, which means this charge is moving up and down at a rate of roughly 500 to 600 times each second. Or sorry, 500 to 600 trillion times each second.
That's a lot.
Very quick.
That's so many.
Very quick oscillation that would generate this out of an antenna, right? And that's the lowest frequency. The highest frequency cone, so that's like, the one of our cones in our eyes, we have three different types, is sensitive to that. The highest one is sensitive to about 600 to about 750 terahertz, so again, trillions of oscillations a second, right? And the middle one's obviously somewhere between those two, right? And the fact that we have three different sensors then means that we can only see light within those two highest to lowest bounds, right? Our eyes can't perceive frequencies higher than the highest frequency and lower than the lower frequency. So even though electromagnetic waves can have a variety of different frequencies, only some of them are visible to us. And so we call the light that lies within that frequency band visible light. Anything above that, anything at higher frequency, we call ultraviolet. Beyond ultraviolet, we say they're X-rays. You might have heard of those if you've ever been scanned for a broken bone or something like that. And then below the lowest frequency band that we can see, we have infrared, so below red. And that includes microwaves and radio waves, the very long, very small frequency light. Okay, so since we're looking at color, though, we're not going to think about infrared, we're not going to think about ultraviolet, we're going to focus on just the visible band. So what we can actually detect and see with our eyes, all right?
Sure.
So, as we said before, light that lies within that band that is oscillating at only a single frequency is known as a spectral color, and it's one that appears on the rainbow, right? And in practice, just for context, a common source of monochromatic light, so light at only a single frequency, is a laser. It's actually quite difficult to produce monochromatic light out of anything other than a laser, specifically one specific frequency. It's pretty difficult to create. You can filter out other frequencies if you want, but so lasers are a common
generating
source.
That.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly. But I want to point out these spectral colors, so the rainbow colors, are not the only colors that exist, right? And this is actually it's kind of funny. There's quite a few articles and videos on the old internet that claim that colors that aren't on the rainbow, such as pink or magenta or fuchsia, and even sometimes purple, which is maybe distinct from violet, they sometimes, as a headline or as a clickbait title might say, these are fake colors or our brains are being fooled. There's not a real color that actually exists.
Yeah, I've seen these before. Right?
And, you know, I get what they're saying, but what is true is that these hot pinks and magentas and fuchsias and all these sort of purplish colors, they are not made of a single color, right? They're not made of a single frequency of light, right? Because, like you said, those are on the rainbow. But to say the other colors don't exist is kind of silly, because all you need is to combine two different frequencies at the same time. And look at that. You have another color, right? Like your eyes perceive another color. Fuchsia exists. Magenta exists. It's just a combination of two different frequencies at the same time.
Yeah, it's like saying sandwiches don't exist.
Exactly.
Sandwiches is a fake meal.
So true.
Because you had to combine things to get it.
It's not even real. Not even real, guys. These purplish colors, these magentas, fuchsias, whatever, they are what we perceive when our highest frequency cone and our lowest frequency cone are excited at relatively equal proportions. And our middle cone isn't excited very much. So if you get two frequencies of light that are one's hitting the red cone and one's hitting the blue cone, then you'll see purples, magentas, whatever, right? To say that light isn't real is a little bit of an overstatement, right? There isn't a single frequency in that color, but it's still a color, right? That's like saying white is an imaginary color, right? White is just the color we see if all three of our cones are hit. So let's say we have three different colors of light, or maybe all the colors of light hitting our eyes at once in relatively equal proportions, we're going to see white because that's just all the colors combined, right? That's what our brain says is white. So you following along so far, Ian?
Yeah.
So there's actually a lot of complexity to color perception, right? I'm kind of just scratching the surface a bit to kind of get you an idea of how it works. One really cool, in my opinion, way of kind of getting your brain wrapped around color perception is with chromaticity diagrams. They're super interesting. There's a link we'll put on the bottom here. I would recommend you look at it if you're interested in this kind of stuff, because I didn't know much about it, and then I looked into it, and we delayed the episode because I was like, this is fascinating. You need to learn more about this. A bit beyond the scope of a single podcast episode, and frankly, it probably works better in a visual medium anyway. So there's some links down there if you're interested. Every color that doesn't exist in the rainbow, which is most colors, right? Teals, purples, pinks, those aren't on the rainbow, right? All of those colors are just made up of having light at multiple frequencies at once, right? All hitting your eye at the same time and letting your cones in different proportions, right? The reason we perceive different colors is just because our cones are being hit at different proportions of light at any given moment. That's what determines what color we see. So let's go back to Kansas.
Let's.
So in Kansas, everything is shades of brown and white because it's sepia and it's the 50s and Technicolor is just becoming a thing. And interestingly, brown, what color is brown, Ian? Let me put that to you.
Me?
Yeah.
Well, one thing I learned when I was mixing paints in elementary school was I could just mix a lot of paints together and I would often just get brown. There I was thinking I'm going to get something really cool if I put like yellow and blue and green together, and it I just picked three random colors and they combine to make green, don't they?
They do. Don't forget a red in there. Put a red in there too.
We'll throw a red in there. And bomb. It's brown. How disappointing.
Yeah. So what frequency is brown then?
It's a combination of many of them. None of them. You ever seen a brown light before? I doubt it.
Well, fascinating, I think. So there's a really good, again, there's a lot of links on this episode because I got super deep into this and it's super interesting to me. There's a link by a great YouTube channel called Technology Connections. They do a lot of interesting things. But there's one episode I watched, a few months ago that kind of came back to me as I was thinking about this, all about the color brown and what it is and how we see it. And I highly recommend you watch that as well. Because brown is actually just low-intensity orange light.
Oh.
And orange is on the rainbow. So there actually is a frequency of light corresponding to brown. The reason we perceive it, and this is kind of a Cliff Notes version of the video, I do recommend watching it if you're interested. The Cliff Notes is, we perceive it as brown when it's surrounded by brighter lights all around it. So if you have like dull, low-intensity orange light surrounded by a bunch of white, it'll look brown to you. But if you're surrounded by black, then all you see is orange. It's really cool.
That's way cool.
Yeah, right? Okay, so what does that mean for the scene then? Okay, so if all we see is browns and whites and like lighter shades of brown, I guess that means that in the universe of Kansas, all light is oscillating at approximately 500 trillion times a second, which is orange, 600 nanometer wavelength, the color orange.
Interesting.
Which is a little odd.
The world worked differently back then.
I guess. Or if there is ever another frequency present, it comes along with every other frequency in roughly equal proportions because you never see any other hue. You just maybe see white or whiter versions of things. So there's always either equal color spread or it's all dim orange.
Womp womp.
Which is interesting. However, once you leave his boring old Kansas behind and come to Oz, all of a sudden the light in this new universe that she's in isn't forced to follow those weird arbitrary 500 trillion oscillations per second rules anymore. Now it can be any frequency.
Yay.
Well, I should be careful. Not any frequency. In this universe.
Not the forbidden frequency. Not the
forbidden frequency. Light can be essentially any frequency or any combination of frequencies in any other proportions they want, as long as those frequencies are within the gamut capturable by Technicolor cameras, because apparently in this universe, right, cameras is like part of the universe, it seems. And this is, again, there's another YouTube video link if you're interested in Technicolor. So most color things, screens, displays, cameras, whatever, they capture three colors, right? And they combine those three colors, like our eyes do, to create other colors.
Yeah.
But when you get deep into these chromaticity diagrams, you look at them, the fact that there's three colors means that you're inherently never going to be able to see every color with just those three combinations. There's some colors you cannot see. There's always some parts of the rainbow you can't see. So in this world, almost any color combination is possible. But interestingly, the rainbow, you know, she's always saying about over the rainbow, right? That rainbow isn't the same rainbow as we have. It's missing some parts of it. There can't be all the whole rainbow in a Technicolor world, which is pretty cool. I think.
How about that?
Yeah. All right, so...
Huh.
That's what's going on in this scene. Light changed from being only one frequency, the sort of dull orange or white, so a combination of all frequencies or the one frequency, to being most frequencies are now allowed. More like our world.
Sure.
All right, yeah. So that's color in a nutshell. There's a lot more that we could talk about that I'm not an expert on, so that's why I didn't talk about it to that
extent. So much.
But there's a lot of cool things, and hopefully if you're interested, you can look at these links and follow these videos and stuff. I thought it was fascinating. But with that out of the way, color. Where do we see it in the world today?
Are we talking about where we see color in the world?
Tell me, Ian.
I mean, where don't we see it?
That's a good question.
Only in darkness. Or in really, really bright light when our eyes get overloaded. But that doesn't have to do with our rods and cones. It has to do with our apertures or whatever. What am I supposed to do for examples of where we see?
Well, you could be like, what about, I don't know. I got a few, though, if you're...
Okay, yeah, you go ahead.
Sounds good. So actually, you brought up one earlier, which is mixing paints, right? And this is really interesting. So the whole thing's interesting to me. I don't know. It's really cool. I learned a lot when I was writing this script. Why, Ian, you mentioned this before, why is it that mixing all the colors of paint together make a dull brown or black, but mixing all the colors of light together makes white? Those seem very opposite. Why do you think that is? Pose a question for you.
Why would you do this?
It's like, I mean, if you don't want to answer it.
Here's my theory. It's because the, because I don't remember this from physics. It's because the paints come together. And paint doesn't bring with it any intensity, any brightness.
Oh, yeah, sure. So so there's an interesting thing here, right? Different ways that objects are visible to us, right? An object can emit light, like a light bulb or a screen or a display or something like that. Or an object can only reflect light, right? And it's not emitting light itself. It's just bouncing light from some other emitter off into your eyes, right? And this is the, right, the primary difference between an additive color and subtractive colors. So pigments are what we call a subtractive colors. So what that means is pigments are chemicals, right? There's some sort of a chemical, some molecule structure that due to that specific molecule, that specific chemical's electron configuration, the electrons inside of it, it can absorb some frequencies of light. So if white light hits a pigment, it'll absorb one or two or maybe a couple different frequencies of light. So some colors, but all the other frequencies of light will bounce off and be re-emitted or scatter, right? And so that means that if white light hits, let's say, a green pigment or maybe a red pigment, that means that the red light is the only light that's being bounced off. Every other light is being absorbed by the pigment. So, Ian, if you mix a bunch of pigments together, what's happening? If you have white light coming in on let's say there's a red pigment, which absorbs everything but red, and a blue pigment that absorbs everything but blue, if you mix those things together and the white light hits both at the same time, what light is being absorbed, what light is being bounced back?
All of it.
Say more.
And none of it?
Say more. So let's say they have these red and blue pigments all mixed together, right?
Uh-huh.
When the light hits that material, some of it is hitting the red pigment, and therefore it's absorbing everything but the red light. And and that red light then is also being transmitted into the blue pigment, which absorbs everything but the blue. So the red light is also absorbed. It absorbs both, it absorbs everything but red and everything but blue. And those Venn diagrams mean that no light ends up being, or all the light ends up being absorbed, right? Everything but red and everything but blue means everything, because red and blue are opposite sides of the spectrum, right?
Yep.
So that means that if pigments are combined, then when the white light hits it, because it's subtractive, it subtracts off every frequency. So you end up getting, well, there's some light that bounces back, obviously, but it equally absorbs every frequency at the same time. So you get no color. You get a dim white, which is a gray. Or if you have them mixed in slightly different proportions, a brown, if there's a little bit of orange light that's still bouncing off. Okay, so that's
this was a trick. This was pigments. This isn't light.
Well, pigments are defined by how they interact.
We're talking about color. We're not talking about light.
It's true. Okay,
but I'm still mad about it.
It's okay, and that's interestingly why. So a screen, like a display on your phone or on your TV or whatever, those by definition they're emitting light, right?
Yeah.
So the light they give off is going to be made up of whatever light they're emitting. So we always have R, G, and B, red, green, and blue lights make up all the monitors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those lights, if all three of them shine, one of those is hitting each of your cones, right? So if you get all of them at once, your whole eye lights up and you see white because all the cones are being simulated. And they can create different colors by varying the intensity of the different colors. Okay. Any other examples of color in the world, Ian?
One thing that always bugged me that astronomers do.
Ooh, all right.
Okay,
let's gossip about astronomers.
Let's gossip about astronomers. All the big, cool telescopes you see.
Mm.
Here's the thing: astronomers don't use telescopes as we think of anymore, right? They're not looking with their eyeball through a eyepiece into a big magnifier that looks at the stars. That's for tourists nowadays. What they use are radio detectors or other things outside of the visible range, the visible spectrum. But then they take those images and they add color to them to make you think that you could look out into galaxies and nebulas and see these really cool gases that are green and purple and blue. It's a lie, everyone. I was so disappointed when I found that out.
I think you're slightly misrepresenting this, I think, a little bit.
I don't think so.
So they definitely still take visual light. There are still telescopes that do that. But you're right. A lot of telescopes, and including like the James Webb, they are able to take pictures outside of the visible spectrum. Right? They're able to absorb different frequencies beyond what we can normally see. But then how do you display that? You can't display it because it's invisible, like by definition.
Yeah, I get why they do it. I'm just upset.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Fair enough. That's
no, I don't. Yeah. Color is so interesting, and I don't have anything to say about it.
Fair enough. The last example I'll bring up is why nature, almost unilaterally, certainly plants, are green. That's a color. And why is everything green?
Explain that.
Why the heck is everything green? So you're probably familiar that chlorophyll is the thing inside of plants. It's a pigment, just like we described before. It's a thing that absorbs most colors of light but one. A green pigment, therefore, absorbs light at either end of the spectrum. So the red light and the blue light is absorbed, but the things in between, the green light that our eyes perceive as green, is not absorbed. Mm-hmm. So it bounces off, and therefore, since we see it bouncing off leaves, we see the leaves as green, right?
Yeah, right. Easy.
Yeah. And so that's how chlorophyll works, as most pigments work. But what was interesting is I was looking into it. So I should say there's technically a lot of different types of chlorophyll, but they all generally absorb light in the same way, with, you know, red and blue being absorbed. But why do they not absorb green? Wouldn't they want to? That's more energy. Like, the whole point of chlorophyll is to take energy from the sun, right? They're missing out on an entire band of frequencies that they could be absorbing. So why don't all plants look black? Why don't they absorb all the colors? Because then they get more energy out of the sun, right?
Yeah, your logic makes sense to me.
Interesting question. And it's interesting partially because there's not really a known answer. There's a hypothesis. There's a few theories. And I thought one of them is really interesting. It's called the Purple Earth Hypothesis. Have you heard this before?
No.
Oh, it's really cool. So chlorophyll is a pigment, right, that exists inside of plants. I think only plants. I don't know. It probably shows up in other things. I'm not going to say a definitive statement, but...
Come on, say definitive statements so people can correct us.
But there is a simpler pigment that existed inside of life forms on Earth called retinol. I'm assuming retinol is in our retina, but that's just a guess. Maybe it isn't, but it's called retinol, so whatever. And retinol primarily absorbs green, right? And the theory goes that back in the day, like 3 billion years ago, before plants were everywhere on the planet, there was these archaea, these older things. I don't know if they're plants, but they, you know, I'm not a biologist, but earlier life forms that got energy from the sun, but using retinol instead of chlorophyll, because chlorophyll is more complex. It hadn't evolved yet, right? And therefore, since these things kind of dominated the Earth, they're absorbing green, which is right in the middle of the spectrum, so it kind of makes sense that they'd, you know, aim for the bullseye, take the middle of the spectrum rather than try to aim for either side, evolutionarily speaking. And so therefore, they were reflecting blue and red light, and therefore the Earth, this is why it's called the Purple Earth Hypothesis, the Earth would have looked purple, just like it looks green now.
Whoa. Right?
I think that's probably an overstatement because there probably lives in the ocean, I'd imagine. Again, I'm not that big of an expert on this hypothesis, but whatever. And so the theory goes that because these archaea were using retinol and were absorbing green and emitting the other colors, that there was a evolutionary advantage to not bother trying to absorb green because it's already being taken care of by all these other things. You're not going to get much of it. And instead absorb the other colors on the sides of the band, the red and the blue.
Yeah.
And somehow, probably because they're on both sides of the spectrum, who knows, plants won out. And the archaea, there's still a few of them alive, but most of them died out. They lost the battle. And therefore, the things that remained are the ones that don't bother absorbing the middle of the spectrum because they wouldn't have served them 3 billion years ago. That's the Purple Earth Hypothesis. Super cool.
Maybe the purple stuff tasted better.
That's probably true. That's why they died out. Humans came around and were like, purple.
Yeah, it tastes way better than green.
I believe it. All right.
That's interesting. Thanks for sharing.
That's my last color digression. I've done a lot of digressions today, but.
Wonderful. Do you want to give a color punchline?
Color punchline. No.
So let's talk about questions from the audience. Folks, if you have questions for us, you can tweet at us at Podcast Frames. You can email us, referenceframespodcast@gmail.com. You can yell into the wind, and we probably won't get it.
But we might.
I've yet to receive anything via carrier pigeon, but that would actually be pretty cool.
That's true.
So our question this week comes from at Kieran McKeag once again. I don't know who that is.
What a last name. What a dumb last name. Silly, I bet his middle name's bad too.
Oh, you better watch yourself. Speaking of physics, there is a trend going around on social media where people wet their fingers and press them to their hotel bathroom mirror to see if it's a two-way mirror. But they leave the light on in the bathroom. Would this trick work?
Mm.
So this is a follow-on to our episode about one-way, two-way mirrors, reflection.
Yeah, the visual suspects, I believe.
The visual suspects, yeah. If you will.
Very good, clever, punny title. Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm not on the TikTok much. I'm apparently too old. I'm left behind by the Zoomers, I suppose. But we looked up some examples of this, and maybe I'm seeing the wrong videos, but what I'm seeing, and this might be a different trend, who knows? Correct us if we're wrong. What I'm seeing is people putting their fingernails up to the mirror and seeing if their fingernail, if the, you know, the glass plate in front of the mirror is separating their fingernails from the fingernail's reflections. Like, it's like there's like space. Even when you're touching the mirror, there's space between you and your reflection. You're not actively touching each other in the reflection.
Or as the saying goes, no space, leave this place.
Exactly. And then therefore, yeah, so then most mirrors have a glass plate, so you're seeing there's some space. And then if there isn't space, that means you're touching directly to the reflective coating, and so your reflection is actively touching your fingernail. So I don't think this makes much sense to me, at least as far as my understanding goes, for two-way mirrors or one-way mirrors. Because the point of a one-way mirror is that it's just partially reflective. It's what we call half silvered or some proportion silvered. So the glass plating doesn't actually affect the ability of a mirror to be a two-way mirror or not. The important thing, what I suspect is going on, is that these mirrors with no glass plating or very thin glass plating might just be lower quality, cheaper mirrors. Maybe it's just a piece of metal that's been polished. There's no glass put onto it, either for durability's sake or for cost-saving sake. I don't know. Because the only reason you have that space is if there's a glass there. And to my knowledge, the glass isn't a part of the whole two-way mirror phenomenon. Does that answer the question you think, Ian?
Yeah. Well, yeah, kind of.
Okay. So I'm not sure about licking your finger.
We've sort of debunked the quick myth,
yeah,
or the quick test of using your finger, you know, and if there's a gap saying, yes, this is a mirror, and if there's no gap saying, oh, no, this is actually a window with a reflective side. We did see one video where the person also cupped their hands around their eyes and then pressed their faces against the mirror. Mm-hmm. And that would be a way for you to cut out light from your side so that you can see through properly. But, of course, the best way to do it would be to turn your flashlight on your phone. Just push it right up against the reflective surface.
Exactly.
And then if you can see through, you know what's going on.
Exactly. I think that answers that question.
So I think we got that. There we have it. We talked about light. We talked about
colors.
Andor. We talked about color. We talked about mirrors. We talked about reflections.
We dissed every astronomer out there.
I dunked on astronomers. Take that, astronomers. Y'all a bunch of dorks.
Next time we're coming for you, astrologers. Watch your backs.
We're now officially a physics diss track
podcast. We're dunkers, what we are.
Everyone's on our list. Chemists. Biologists.
They're stamp collectors, right?
Mathematicians, software engineers.
Well, not those guys. No.
Not the software engineers?
I don't want to. We're like an internet-based.
That's a good point. Manufacturing engineers.
The worst.
We'll get them.
We'll get them.
You got any parting words for the people?
You know, not really. I will say this episode has reminded me one of the many reasons why I like physics so much is it's a great avenue into so many other things that are also fascinating. Like, I didn't know much about color theory, but I knew about colors and monochromatic light and lasers and how light works. But I wasn't really sure how displays work or how pigments work entirely. So I had a lot of fun in this episode because I was kind of led into it. Sometimes it's good to think about something and then pursue it deeper to see if you can understand it more. And that's what I did this episode, yeah. If you could tell by the runtime. I had a lot of fun going deeper into something. And I think you will, too, if you give it a shot.
Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening to this episode. And we can't wait for you to listen to us next time.
Woo! Bye. And for us to listen to you by your questions or corrections.
And not with our ears pressed against your front door.
Hold up! Why are you talking about in there? You guys having dinner? Talking about the spectrum, brother. Light, color. Talking about the spectrum, brother. Light, color. Talking about